Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that this man was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. After saying this, he spit on the ground and made some mud with the saliva and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. And this word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that it was. Others said, no, he just looks like him. But the man insisted, I am that man. How then were your eyes opened, they asked. He said, the man called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see. Where's this man, they asked. I don't know. They brought the Pharisees to the man who had been blind. Now, the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees asked him how he had received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed, and now I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a sinner perform such signs? And so they were divided. Then they turned again to the blind man. What do you say about him? It was your eyes that were open. The man said, well, he's a prophet. They did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They said. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? We know it's our son, the parents answered. And we know that he was born blind, but how he can see or how his eyes were opened, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He can speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who already decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That's why the parents said, he's of age. Ask him. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth. We know this man is a sinner. He replied, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I do know is that I was blind and now I see. They asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? I've already told you, but you don't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You want to become his disciples? Then they hurled insults at him. You are this fellow's disciples. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses. But as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. The man answered, now that's remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens only to God, the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. And if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, you are steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? They threw him out. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and he found him and said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir? The man asked. Tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you have now seen him, because he is the one that you're speaking. About a month ago, we were standing down here at our 9:30 service when we went to two services the first time. And our staff, usually in 9:30, has a tradition where we sit on the front row. And part of that is just to support each other and just be in this worship experience together. And the other part is because it leads by example. You lead from the front. That's what you do. That's how we try to lead at this church. But I was standing down here, and my two daughters, Ella and Emery, they came and they stood next to me during worship on the front row. And we were just enjoying a time of worship together. And I know many of you are parents. There's something very special about watching your kids worship with you. And so we were singing Waymaker, and our kids all know the words of that song. And Emery, my youngest, she was holding my hand through the entirety of the service. And you know, here we are in the front of the church. We're just worshiping together. I mean, this is what we've tried to do. And I'm actually getting a little emotional. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, my child's here. We're worshiping together. And I lean down, you know, kind of in the middle of the song. And I said, I looked at her and I said, thank you for coming and spending time in worship with me today. Without missing a beat, she looked up at me and she whispered, Mom told us to. So we're not forming these kids at all. And anyway, I mean, it's all just a ruse. It's terrible. We're talking about a story today. Jesus and the man who had been born blind. That there's this story that unfolds here in John chapter 9, and it actually is, it's kind of a humorous story. You could just see the banter back and forth between this man and the religious leaders and everything that's happening in the midst of this story. And we see Jesus doing something miraculous. It's overwhelmingly miraculous. Not just somebody that's gone through a hard time in their life, but this man is probably 30 or 40 years old. We know that because it says he is of age, meaning he is a grown man in the temple. He is allowed to speak for himself. And we know, based on what is told in the story, that he is somebody who is born blind. And we see the initial miracle, that Jesus has come to heal blindness. But as the story unfolds, we realize it's not just the physical blindness of this man. But there is this spiritual blindness that is captivating the landscape with those that call themselves religious. Yes, Jesus does a miracle and gives this man his sight that he has not had at all in his life. But the bigger picture and the bigger story is about the spiritual blindness that is taking place in the lives of all these religious leaders and those who follow the old ways. And we see very quickly, as this story unfolds with the religious leaders, what do they choose to see? What do they choose to see? Well, they choose to see what you and I choose to see, even what the disciples choose to see in the beginning. You know, we're not that different, even though we're separated by almost 2,000 years of history. The questions that we ask are the same questions. The way that we experience the world is the same thing. And even in our world today, there is a question that dominates when something happens in our lives, and that is, who is to blame? If you turn on the TV and you watch commercials, it's very easy to pick this narrative up. Were you injured in a car accident? Did you work in unsafe conditions disposing of chemicals? Have you had extended exposure to asbestos? The narrative that our world is constantly pouring into us is we've got to find who it is to blame. Who is at fault for something that is happening in our lives? And we live, consequently, in a blame and shame culture. That's what we do. We try to find who's to blame for it, whose fault it is, and then how can we get retribution or revenge against that person? Or how can I say something to you that makes you feel less and makes you accept blame? I know that sometimes the millennials get a bad rap for this, but the reality is we all tend to do this. When difficult things happen, we try to find the genesis of it. Who is to blame? I remember about 10 years ago, I was doing staff reviews at the end of the year, which we traditionally did. And we had a couple of employees at our church that did not have great time management skills, which is a nice way to say they were late to everything, okay? Now, I'm one of those people that I believe that being on time is a sign of respect and honor, and we should always do our best. I know there's times where things come up, but we should always do our best to be on time for things. It tells that other person, I value you, I value your time, I'm not going to waste your time. Now, unfortunately, in our world today, we have overpiled our schedules, and so we're always running from one thing to the next to the next. But I remember we sat down for this review, and we were talking about everything, and really, this person had done a pretty good job on most things, and I said, okay, now at the end of the day, we've got to talk about you have to be on time for this stuff. You have to be here when you are needed to be here. And the response that came was this: it's not that big a deal. And I'm not as late as this other person. And I said, I'm going to talk to that other person. But the only thing that decides if you're late or on time is that thing that hangs on the wall. And you need to be here when you commit and when you say you're going to be here. See, just want to shift the blame and let's look at something else. Let's look at something different. And sometimes when we're in a relationship, well, the one thing we know when something goes bad, it's definitely not me. It's got to be them. So if we can just figure out what they did, then our lives will be happier and healthier. And we've gone down this rabbit hole of blame and shame. When was the last time you heard somebody say, I really messed that up. I could have done that so much better. I totally missed the boat on that. But I'm going to work hard to improve that moving forward. It's very hard to be introspective. It's very hard to say, I have failures and flaws in my life. You know, one thing that's funny, though, is we never blame things that benefit us. When was the last time you heard somebody come home and go, I am so frustrated. I went into my boss's office and they gave me a huge bonus and a raise. Why are they doing that? You know, when it comes to God, you know, God, why are you blessing our family so immensely right now? Why would you do that? We only complain about the stuff that we don't like. We often do not see the things that are beautiful and wonderful. We're not always thankful for those things. What about this man in the story, this man that was blind and now he sees? What does he choose to see in this story? The narrative is so humorous. I love the way, I bet if we could write this in modern language, as he's describing for the second and third time to these religious leaders, he basically at the end of the day says, let me put it to you this way, I was blind and now I see. Duh. Like it's almost like that, like he needs to say that to be emphatic with them. And then he throws in that little sarcastic comment, which I think is brilliant. Oh, do you guys want to be disciples? Is that why you want to do this? And they kick him out for that. You're a sinner. We blame you. We shame you. You're just an awful person. You must have done something wrong, or your parents must have done something wrong. How dare you lecture us about your life? But what this man chooses to see is he chooses to accept the healing and acknowledge who Jesus is. He accepts redemption over his life. And he says, look, nobody bad could have done this. This person obviously has something that I don't have or that you don't have because you've not been able to heal me. That's really what he's saying. I've been here. You don't even want to let me in the temple. But this man came along, took pity on my life, redeemed me, cleansed me, and now I'm a new person. And I'm going to acknowledge that person. I don't care what you guys have to say. As we read this story, what do we choose to see? Obviously, there's a physical blessing and a physical miracle in the story, but there is this issue of spiritual blindness that Jesus is starting to kind of nurture and help us to see. You know, when difficult things happen in our lives, we all seem to do the same thing. I hear this all the time. Even in counseling settings, people will say, I need to come and talk to you about something. I say, okay. And they'll tell me a bad story. Maybe it's a bad breakup, or maybe it's family problems, or maybe life at work is not going so well, or they're struggling to make friends, or they're struggling to connect, and all these different things. Or they're facing a tragedy, or they've just been through a tragedy. Most people will ask this question at some point. Why do bad things happen? Why are the bad things taking place in our lives? You know, if we step back from where we are right now, we're going to learn some unique lessons. I hear people talking about COVID all the time, and they're almost always talking about it in a bad way. I want to tell you something. I don't think it's that bad a thing. I'm not saying I don't believe it's, you know, real. I just don't think the consequences of it are that bad. In fact, I think we've needed these consequences for a while. One of the lessons that we learn is that we need valleys in order to enjoy mountains. Sometimes the only way that we know how good it is when we know how bad it is. People are spending time with their families. People are being more cautious. People are developing better hygiene. I mean, that's probably a good thing as well. We're doing things that we've never done before. We're having to think about our lives. We're having to slow down a little bit. Maybe enjoy things that we never enjoyed before. I see parents and kids with bikes and trampolines and pools, and you see people outside and enjoying life in a new way. Maybe we're realizing that overscheduling our lives is not really a sign of success. I think overall, this is a good thing that's teaching us new lessons. And yes, there might be a valley, but that means a mountain is coming. And as people of faith, we learn that God is at work in both good and We're very good at seeing God working when life is good. We're very bad at seeing God working when our lives are not going so well. This is why when Paul writes these words in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, it's a beautiful summary and conclusion of what he is sharing with the church. And he says, "And we know that in all things," that means good and bad, tragedy and blessing, "in all things, God is at work for good to those who love him, who have been called, who are living towards his purpose." What that says in a really simple phrase is, no matter what is going on in your life, God is on your side. And God will be able to reveal and show you what you can learn from this. Now, I want to be very clear. God does not create all things, but God works in all things. Sometimes we confuse this. Sometimes we think, well, God's really, look, I think there's maybe 1% of the time where God says, you're going down a road and you're gonna basically lose your life, and I need to put an obstacle in your way so that you can stop for a second and take a look at me. But 99% of the things that happen in our lives, usually, let's be honest, they're because of bad decisions we've made. But God does not throw things in your life just because there's a certain lesson that you need to learn. So tired of that theology where people act like God is the great puppet master who's doing evil things to us. Life is broken and life is challenging, but when bad things happen or when difficult situations come or when that breakup or that promotion or whatever it is, it says God is still working. And he's working ultimately for your good because you are his child. And the question that we have as we maybe put ourselves as an audience member in the story of John 9, the question we have to ask ourselves is, am I blind or do I see Jesus? Do I like who Jesus is, or would I rather just go back to the way that things used to be? Joshua makes a great statement in Joshua chapter 24. This is where we get the, "As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord." But right before that, he says, if you don't want to follow God, if you just want to do the ancient things, then you can keep doing that. But we're going to follow God where God is leading, and we're going to be a people of him. Watch what happens at the end of John chapter 9, right after Jesus has proclaimed to this man that he is the Messiah. It says, "Then the man said, Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come to this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some of the Pharisees who were there heard and asked, "What, are we blind now?" Jesus says, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." What he is saying in this text is that if you see me, you have to make a choice. I have found in my experience of finding and following Jesus that Jesus almost always takes me somewhere that I don't want to go. And he challenges my viewpoint and my belief system and my theology. And what do you really believe about this, Sheldon? You see, we have this way of believing that's comfortable to us. And Jesus almost always violates that comfort when he calls us. When he says, "Follow me," it's always to the place that we don't want to go. This man got thrown out of the synagogue, but he really wasn't in there anyway. The disciples have to choose, do we go back to the old ways where we're comfortable, where we know where all the boundaries are, where all the rules are? Do we step into religion again, or do we step into this thing called faith? And every one of us, when we encounter God in our lives, we have to make a decision about whether we're going to step back or whether we're going to move forward. And let me give you the cheat sheet. Stepping back is always easy. It's known. It's comfortable. It makes us feel warm and good. And taking the hand of Jesus in the darkness and him leading us to light is always going to be difficult and scary and unknown. The question that we have to ask is, do we want to stay blind or do we want to see? If this story said that this man said, "Sight's not all it's cracked up to be. Jesus, if you could put mud back on my eyes, or I'm going to wear double eye patches moving forward because I just prefer being blind. We would say, how absurd. And yet we do that with Jesus. We see him. He calls us. Say, nah, I'd rather just go back. It's not just about having faith. It's about having the courage to have the kind of faith that is scary. It's the choice between seeing Jesus and watching him work or being spiritually blind. That's the narrative that's happening in John 9. And it's a big narrative because it speaks to all of us. You want to see Jesus? We just want to see the version that you like. One is religion. One is courageous. These are the words of God. Father, today, thank you for meeting us in this place. Thank you for giving us just a human story in John chapter 9. Thank you for just sharing a story of that reveals people's insecurities, that just shows our fears, that allows us to see how much blame we try to assign in our lives. But Father, today I just pray that we would hear your voice, that as we witness the scene as it unfolds in our minds, that we would be confronted with the question of, do we see or are we blind? Thank you for giving us grace to be your children. Thank you for allowing us to hear your voice. Thank you for taking care of our physical needs, our brokenness, our shame, our struggles. And Father, I just pray today that we would make the difficult choice of having courageous faith. Thank you so much just for inviting us to be a part of this today, to listen to what you have to share with us. We pray that as we worship, we speak words of truth as we go on about our weeks, God, that we would not be blind, but that we would follow you in light and life. Thank you for meeting us here. We pray all these things in your precious Son's name, and the whole church together says.